Boker Tov world. Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, is daf Ayin Hei. And we got up to the first long line on the daf. Kol HaMumin SheParoslim is exactly where we were up to. And so that was the next case that we had in the Mishnah. We spoke about the entire problem of Nedarim, Kiyum HaTnai, whether a person is Meichel HaTnai, whether things changed afterwards, and so on. Now we get into the next part of the Mishnah. The next part of the Mishnah talks about the other aspect of the Tanai She'ein Ba Mumin. And then we got to the end of the Mishnah, in which there is taking a woman without making a Tanai, but it turns out that she has Nidorim, that itself is considered to be a Pagam, even if he didn't specify. And we had the question, if that's the case, why is there a chiyuv and a get? Why is there only a p'tur from the ksuva? With all of the possible explanations that maybe that was only a derabbanan, which got us into all of the questions, you know, the mosubilas, and so on. And then the next thing that we spoke about, and we'd initially juxtaposed the two issues. We juxtapose the inyan of the making a tanai legabi nedarim and with the inyan of making a tanai legabi mumin. And then when we get to the end of the Mishnah, we speak about the other juxtaposition, which is the question of it was determined that she did have nedarim without his having said anything. In other words, the kuchastam, the konsistam, the way that Shmuel was understanding it. And then we speak about if we actually find mumin as well. And the Mishnah defines, what do we mean by mumim? Kol mumim sheposlim b'kohanim. So we say anything that would make it impossible for kohen to do the aveda in the Beis Hamikdash are considered to be mumim in the context of a nisuin as well. So if he said that he doesn't want any mumim, it includes any of those mumim. So now the question is, are there additional mumim that would have implications for marriage? Yes, says in the Braita, Hosifo Aleihem, there are some things that don't pasul konim from the Aveda, but they do pasul a woman if he's makbid on mumin. And what is that? Ze'a, so this is a woman who always smells sweaty. Shuma, a mole, which will define what kind of mole. V'reach haper, and bad breath. So that means that a kohen who would be with those mumim, apparently we're saying, would not be psul, and only a woman would be psula if he's makbid on these mumim. Now, is that true? Bahani b'kohani lo pasli, are we indeed claiming that mumim like that will not psul a kohen from the Aveda? The Atnan, the Mishnah that writes, remember, first the Mishnah goes over all of the mumim on an animal, and then it goes on to say that those same mumin will pasul the kohanim, and then it adds the various things that pasul kohanim and that are found by kohanim and not nogea, the animal. So it does say about an animal that if the animal for the korba is zaken, or it's chole, and here's the important thing to us, or it's mizoham. So mizoham means that it smells basically disgusting. Now, I mean, that sounds the same as the Zeya V'Reach HaPeh, which also have to do with smell. So, I mean, a mizoham is detected through smell, and l'chor, it's the same thing as Zeya and Reach HaPeh. And the Mishnah continues on, and the Sefer, which is the next Mishnah, that mumim elu bein kvuim bein ovrim are also pasul akoi b'sulim ba'adam. So now it turns out that a kohen who is mizoham is possible for the Avedas Beis HaMikdash. But the Braisa was Mashma Hosifu Alein, that it's only because we added particular things that are Nogeya to the marriage. Answers the Gemara, Omer Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Hanina, no problem at all. The Braita is talking about a Ze'ah that is Overet. So we have this, yes, we have this constant Ze'ah, which is a problem in marriage, but it can be that there are times when he doesn't have an attack of the Zeya. So it's not continuous, it's continual, because we still have the problem of saying that the mumin whether it's a mum over, it's a mum kavua, so it doesn't mean over it in that sense. It means it's not a continuous issue, and there would be times that the kohen would be able to be even in the Beis HaMikdash if he's not having that particular problem. And this is actually part of that syndrome of extra perspiration, which is a big problem. There's different ways of treating it nowadays, but that is not there all the time. So that in those periods in which it's not a problem, he would be able to be oved in the Beis HaMikdash. And that would be not acceptable in the marriage because he's always around his wife. Mashen ken a kohen would go to the Beis HaMikdash, whatever it is, if it's 2 days a year or an hour a year, whatever it is, but he would still be kosher for the Aveda at times. So we can't say that it passes him. It just makes him at the time. We'd be like, okay, so if he were Shosru Yayin, he also couldn't do the Aveda. So if at that moment he is sweating, so he can't do the Aveda, it's inappropriate. Mashenke in the Mishnah that talks about that everything that's in a behemoth, such as Mesuham, is also in an Odom, that's talking about where that's a constant and it is continuous. And therefore, it would pass or a coin, because it would be no way that he could ever do the Aveda. Ravashi says, I don't know what you guys are talking about, really. You're comparing apples and oranges over here. How are you asking a stira between Mizuham to Ze'ah? They're not at all the same. Mizuham means that there's something rotten about the actual body of this animal or of the coin. It's not that there's something that is creating a smell like sweat, which you could always wash off, or you could use a deodorant, or you could dip the coin into vinegar and let him sit there for a little bit till it takes off the smell. I mean, it's not his actual skin that is rotten. A mizoham means that there's something rotting in the animal itself that is detected by smell, or in the human himself. So maybe there's some kind of infection or gangrene or whatever, but that is not Zea. You're comparing two things that are completely unrelated. So where you're talking about mizoham, that means that no matter what you're going to do, all you can do is cover up the smell, but you'll never be able to remove that smell because there is something that is emitting that smell from the actual body. And that is just putrid. And that, of course, is going to passel the kohen. That's not what we're talking about here. So if we're talking about the question of sweating, so asim gabi kohenim efshila abra b'kiyud acharma, I mean, you could always basically use vinegar, you know? And dip the coin in vinegar. Vinegar is a great remover of various odors. And I actually use vinegar as the, they use vinegar in mouthwasher. I use vinegar for everything, fabric softener. So fantastic. You don't need any of these cover-up smells. You put in vinegar into your washing machine in the rinse cycle. And everything comes out smelling amazing because it removes everything. It softens the material as well. Takes out all of the deposits of minerals and so on. Terrific. So anyway, all we need to do is dip the kohen in vinegar and give him a vinegar bath, and then he's fine. You know, same thing is true about Reach HaPeh. I mean, you can do the same thing. You can use Efshar Denakat. I mean, good to use mouthwash, you know, or a peppercorn you keep in the mouth, or you put in some mint, you know, one of these really murderous mints like Big Heddy used to chew, you know, and that would be enough to take away temporarily, you know. Okay, but Lamaisit, for that moment, he could be over. Well, you can't, obviously can't live with a wife who needs to always be in a tub full of vinegar, you know. I mean, that's not exactly a way to build a home. And it would be impossible for her to always have mouthwash in her mouth. So the end result is she's going to get you with that halitosis, man. She's going to get you. And therefore, because of that, if this guy is makbid on mum, so this is a mum. And therefore, you're comparing two different things. Gabi Yisha lo efshar. You're not able to keep her in the vinegar all day long, you know. Fine. Now let's get on to the next case. We talked about Shuma. And Shuma is a mole. And we don't define what a mole is. I mean, there's different sizes of moles, there's different types of moles. I mean, what are we referring to exactly? So I shuma, hechadanya. If we're talking about a mole with hair, well, hairy moles are considered to passel a kohen and in a woman. E de lespe, shear, then there's another problem. What size of a mole are we talking about? Because if it's talking about a shuma gedola, again, which needs to be defined, so then it's going to be puzzled both by Kohen and by Isha. And Ishuma Kitanahi, Halkabacha lo pasla. And you're telling me that there's a type of shuma, which is bedavka kosher for a Kohen, and puzzle in a marriage. Titania, how do I know all of this, by the way? I mean, because it's a braita. The braita says that a hairy mole is considered to be a mole. So shuma sheyesh ba seyar, harei ze mum. If ain ba seyar, then it depends. If it's a gidola, then it's a mum. If it's a ktana, then it's not a mum. Now, this is talking about legabi akohen as well. Ve'ezohi gidola, pirish Rebbe Shimon ben Gamliel, ad ki isar ha'italki. So the shear is the size of an iser that they use in Italy, and that, of course, that's the iser ha'italki, will come also into play in the Gemara Kedushin, legabi the relationship of creating a Kedushin. So fine, it's like a small coin. And that would be the size. Less than that, it's considered to be cotton. But anyway, we don't see that this would be a mum for an Isha. It's pretty clear. I mean, that it's something that's barely noticeable, and therefore, that's exactly why the coin is kosher with it. So where would we get the idea that an Isha is considered over there, that it is considered to be specifically nogea? Omer Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, yes, there is a difference. The difference is that when we're talking about over here, the size or the type of a shuma, those are talking about wherever it actually would be on the body. It's considered to be a shuma. Masha'inkein, if we're talking about a wife, so then if it's very visible, so it's right there on her forehead, we'll see what we're talking about, why we're talking about a forehead instead of anywhere on her face, because l'chora, there should be no difference, but it will turn out that there is a difference because of the question of the chazaka, but we'll talk about that in a second. But what we're referring to over here is an omedet al padachta. So over there, it's very disturbing. And in a kohen, that it's not nogea, but for a wife, it is nogea. Padachta, I don't understand. If it's right there on her forehead, and he took her in marriage anyway, then obviously he knew about it. How could he not know about it if it's so visible? So then he was ra'av and it payesu. Then we need to assume that since he went ahead, and if he said she doesn't have any mumin, he obviously didn't mean the mumin of which he is clearly aware, because how could he not be aware? Isn't that the point? No, says Rav Papa. Why do you think we said padachta instead of saying that it's on her face? Because the truth is, on her face, there's no way that he didn't know about it. But what we're referring to over here is padachta, where it's near the top of her forehead, and therefore she could have covered it over with a tichel, and it's omedet la tachat kippah shel rosha. So it's possible that he really didn't know. Nonetheless, zimnin de mischazia, v'zimnin de lo mischazia. So since it is visible at times, so because of that, it's considered to be a hakpada. But since it's invisible at times, and there's no way that he would necessarily know about it before, so then we can also, we need to worry that since he didn't know, he wasn't mitpayes, and it is a visible mum that would bother a husband. And therefore, we talk about the padachat, not the ponim, because we don't have the chazaka that he saw was in payes, and we do have the chazaka that a person would be makpid on a mum like this. Fine. I must point out to you that one of the most important elements that we deal with in ksuvas, remember, is a description of the type of chiyuvim that have to do with the nature of biological interrelationships. And that's the entire point. So what we're doing is we're not taking a business partner. We're taking over here the nature of marriage and recognizing that it's profoundly built on things that are completely organic and have nothing to do with the productivity necessarily or anything like that, so that there are profound semi-aware issues that can come to the surface that are either psychological, hormonal, physical, and that these things are necessarily taken into consideration in creating the wherewithal for a relationship to develop. And if we have, therefore, any kind of siman of hakpada, then that is going to affect our ksuv. So even though we said before, listen, I never saw a fox drop dead when it goes into its den, which is a profound insight in the nature of the organic, purely organic connections that marriage deals with. And that's the fact is that, of course, if we were talking about an interrelationship, which is a business interrelationship, then there would be completely different considerations. The very fact that somebody is willing to be married on both sides is an incredible cancellation of the natural tendency on an infant level to just be oneself and thinking that when you are oneself, that's the only time that you're comfortable. And the whole meaning of adolescence and the pressure of getting beyond oneself and creating a shnehem, being together Adam, is a massive change that in which the early psychology and the development of the identity of an infant is now totally challenged, but challenged in ways that has to do with organic realities, very deeply organic realities. And it's not a coincidence that all of the elements of sexuality are very animal. It's not as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu has saved humans from being animals, because we do find one inyan, for instance, that the Gemara says that a woman's breasts are far away from a woman's genitals, which is not the case on animals. And that therefore, this is a chesed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does with humans. And so on. We have a difference because of that. We have a different sense of beauty and value in breasts than we talk about genitals. But sexuality is messy. Sexuality is animal. Sexuality smells. And it involves all types of issues that you would think people are not ready to get involved in. That's the issue that we spoke about before. You cannot taina dvorim shebeino leveina in terms of nidorim because you don't like the din. This is what you got yourself into, buddy, and this is what it's about. And you accepted the fact that you are now an organism driven by animalistic issues and that you're going to accept those animal things as being part of you. And that therefore, that's why the Gemara is not kidding around. Therefore, if a fox lives in its den, then you're going to have to learn to live in your den and accept that aspect of yourself. Now the question is, what about the initial coming together? That's a completely different thing than making a netter and getting things problematic once you've already gotten involved in this type of relationship. So there we understand that the elements that are evolutionarily part of what it would be that would attract me, which you have absolutely no understanding of yourself. You have no idea why this thing attracts you in terms of its pure physicality. You have no idea. You don't understand what element of a bee's attraction to a flower became part of your psychology in the course of evolution that attracted you to this particular structure of a woman that nobody else finds attractive other than you. And those are things that are profound mysteries, and they're really irrelevant in a great sense, because all that we're talking about is your acceptance of the organic realities. And that's the way it is. It's not really important. So the question over here that we need to deal with, what is considered to be acceptable within the context of writing a ksuva in things that would normally be seen as a psychological barrier or a hormonal barrier, and so on and so forth. It's extremely important for the Gemara to deal with this in terms of the ksuva, because that is an opening to what it is that the person needs to recognize is part of what his marriage is involved in. So this is no small issue. And the funny comments of the Gemara are not funny. I mean, they are funny because the human condition is funny, but the issues are real issues. Of course, everything is funny. I mean, that's why sex is called funny. Misachek, the whole thing is funny. Misachek et ishto. It's funny because it's so absurdly inappropriate. Like, what the heck is going on? And that is really crazy. So for a person to find himself suddenly redefined by issues that I don't know what's going on, that is indeed very, very funny. And so because of that, we really need to take the humorous aspect of it in order to be able to survive it. That's what my father spoke to me before I actually went to the chuppah, you know, so when I had this father-son conversation, right? So he shares with me some of his own experiences. And then he says to me, look, whatever goes wrong, the important thing is laugh. Because if you lose your sense of humor, then you're in big trouble. And indeed, that is an amazing reality in all of the development of connections that don't really make sense on the level of seichel, in which you find yourself afloat in the human condition and need to see it with all of its humor. Right? So that's, I think, the Amamish think that that's why the Gemara actually coaches these things in such funny ways. We have these constant funny descriptions of things in the Gemara, and it really is meant to be funny, even though the insights are profound insights.
Okay. And Mesameach Chasen Bedvarim, that we need to be Mesameach the Chasen.
Sameach doesn't mean funny.
Mesameach, but okay.
Mesameach doesn't mean funny. Why are you comparing Zaya to
You need that glue.
It's not funny. Mesameach doesn't mean funny.
But it says Bedvarim. Rashi says Bedvarim.
Dvorim means kamak noa kala zoo. Where did you get the idea that Dvorim means funny?
I don't know, but that's why I make jokes to the chassan. I don't know.
Okay. I guess, I mean, the way we carry on with the silly things that are done and so on, and I guess there's some, you know, funny and not to take things seriously. So you have a good mocker in the idiotic things that we do, or people do anyway. All right. Anyway, so that's the thing over here, says Rav Papa. It's talking about that we can't be sure. Omer Rav Chisda. Let me tell you something. I heard from a great man something that you never would have thought of, okay? And Hamnilta Migava Rabba Shmieli. When I say great man, you know I'm talking about Rabbi Shila. And what he said was that if Nishacha Kelet v'naaseh makomot saleket, harezeh mum. It's not that we have a full list of the nature of mumin in which only the Mishnah and Bechoros is going to be definitive of the Shivim Mumin, and then we have specifically these things about Reach HaPeh and Zeah. No, it's that wherever we can be omed on a common human reaction, we have a right to view those as Mumin. And therefore, Bishila said, look, I mean, we're not going to be able to list everything. For instance, suppose this woman was bit by a dog, right? Some point in her life. It left her with a terrible scar that actually looks like the mouth of a dog. That is a mum. Because even though the thing itself may not necessarily be ugly, but the whole aspect of it that reduces her to an animal level is something that people find ugly. And another thing that is ugly is a woman who has kol aveh. So she's got a man's voice. Kol aveh b'yishah, she's got this deep voice. Harezeh mum. Where do we see that? Shenemar ki kolei charev umareich naveh. We see that the pasuk considers the voice of the woman to be part of what is the beauty in Shir HaShirim of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, the connection to mareich naveh is also to kol. So something that is abnormal in terms of kol is also meant to be considered a mum. Tani Rabbi Nosson Bira. So Rabbi Nosson Bira said a brisa, and he said, Bein dadei isha tefach. If there's a one tefach between a woman's two breasts, now, Rav Acha Bereda Rava, poor Rav Acha, so Rav Acha Bereda Rava, not knowing much about women, he thought that this means, in order for a woman to be really beautiful, her breasts should be separated by a tefach. Okay. So that means tefach l'mal yusas. Rav Ashi says, I got news for you, boy. This is one of the mumin. If you've got a tefach between a woman's two breasts, that's considered to be like Zeya or like Shuma. Vechama. These are amazing Gemaras. So what is considered to be a nice figure? Three etzpaot between two breasts. Tanya, Rabbi Nosson Omer, very large breasts that are significantly larger than normal women's breasts is considered to be a mum. It's not considered to be an advantage, it's a disadvantage. Vechama, how much abnormally larger than normal breasts are we talking about? Amar Amanda, don't tell anybody that this is what you learned on the Daf Yomi this morning. They'll think you're crazy. Anyway, Vechama, this goes hand in hand with the Gemaras about penal sizes that we had before with Rapapa and so on. Absolutely stunning Gemaras, right? So in other words, once we're getting into the organism, oh my gosh, we're really getting into the organism. But hey, you could say you learned in Daf Yomi, size matters. So Omer of Maisha, Barbareda Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Mishmeda Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, if a breast is a tefach larger, so that if you measure the breast from the beginning of the breast on the chest, and it extends a full tefach beyond a normal measurement, that's considered to be a pagan. Ah, come on, whoever heard of breasts a tefach larger than normal breasts? There are such things. Umiika kahai gavna? Absolutely, Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said, I saw it myself. There was this Arab woman who was carrying her kid in a backpack, and the kid wanted to nurse, and she takes her breasts and throws them back over her shoulder. And she gives the kid a breast to nurse on. So things can get pretty bad. And Anira iti arabiya achat ifshila dadea la'achorea v'inika edvina. All right, now once we're talking about Rav Miyasha, u'letzion ye'amer, ish ve'ish yuladba, v'hu yechoneneha elyon. So what does this mean? First of all, what is the meaning of ish ve'ish yuladba? And what does it mean when we say letzion ye'amer? Can we talking to Tzion? Omer Rav Maisha Barbara de Rav Yeshua ben Levi, what it means is that ve'amer, the goyim will say, to Zion they must go. So if I discover an ish, the ish, whether it was literally Yuladba, whether this person was literally born in Yerushalayim, or someone who dreams of Yerushalayim, the goyim will immediately recognize, oh my God, this is a Tzioni. He has to be brought immediately to Tzion. What right do we have to keep him here between us, our low-class goyim? So echad anoladba, ve'echad amitzapeli ra'ota, they will bring to Tzion. Like we talk about atzate amana, they'll carry you, and they'll the malachim will carry you. They'll bring everyone who is shayach to Tzion back to Tzion. So here, this pasuk is mashma that it makes no difference whether you were born in Tzion or whether you just dream of Tzion. But Omer Abaye, you should know that Chad Minayu, one person of these guys who are in Tzion and they live in Eretz Yisrael, they are better than two of us here in Bavel. They're just so much brighter. They're just so much more alive, so much more aware. There's no comparison. Omer Rava, that's true. But one of us goes up there, they're worth two of them because we had to go through all of these compensations in order to make our brains work over here in Bavel and still be functional on some level. So if you add that to the Avir there at Yisrael with all of its chokmah, you end up with something that is much better, which we see this all the time. The people that come from Chutz Laaretz have the additional value once they absorb the Avir there at Yisrael. They have the additional value of everything that was put in for them to survive in Chutz Laaretz. Take an example. You remember Reb Yirmiyah? He got thrown out of the Beis HaMedrash for his stupid questions. Remember him? So when he was here in Bavel, people used to laugh at him. And he didn't know what was going on. But you know, when he moved to Eretz Yisrael, who's the guy that always talks about the dumb idiots in Bavel? Reb Yirmiyah. And he's the guy that calls us the Bavloi Tipshoi. So, you know, I guess you get right up there when you move away. And you get up to Eretz Yisrael. a moment for a word from, is it our sponsor today or just our capitan? So we are brought back to the beginning of the Masechet now with this Mishnah, in that we have to determine who is going to be believed. Now, remember, we started off with all of the machlokas and back at the beginning between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua. Lo mipia nuchoyin, ela rezu becheskas, etc., etc. This is Rabbi Yoshua. And Rabbi Gamliel says, no, she's an emenes. So those were the cases where he claims that she wasn't a basula, and she says, I was raped before after you married me, and therefore it's your nistafka sadecha. Or we have the other tainas about whether she says that she was a mukas eitz, and all of those dafin that we spoke about, and all of those discussions that we had, even about things that have nothing to do with marriage, between the question of bari v'shema and what type of chazaka we rely on, and a cheskas haguf when it comes against a cheskas mama, and those were very, very complex sugyas, which we said over there we pasken like Rabbi Gamliel, but we have not really finished the full understanding of the nature of the interplay of the various chazakas that we have. So we have chazakas that are based on simple organic facts. A woman is born, she's born as a betula. A woman is born, we assume that unless it was known that there were congenital problems, but then it would be known, and then he would have heard about it. But like this, if there's a mum, we say those mumen developed sometime later in life. That's called a cheskas haguf. And those are things that are just the way things are. So we assume, note that the idea of a cheskas haguf is that we assume that when there's a change, that the change took place at whatever later date we discover it took place. Because we know it definitely was not there at the beginning. So that gives us a chazaka that we can look back and say, well, we have no reason to believe that this thing had already developed at such a stage. Then we have a chazaka, which is called a cheskas moment. Now, a cheskas moment is the question of who is currently the one that is holding the object or the money that we want to take out. A cheskas moment is obviously no reason for us to define a reality. I mean, it just happens to be that we need to know what we're doing in order to change the current status of the halacha. So that is a totally different type of chazaka. We need to see how a cheskas mamon stacks up against a cheskas haguf. Then we have chazakas that have to do with psychology. And there are the questions of what can we assume was the way that things developed because of human psychology. So, for instance, we have a chazaka that a person will not accept a mum. We have a chazaka that a person will not go to a chuppah without making sure that he knows what he's marrying. Those are things that don't have to do with realities that are defined by simple physical facts. Those are chazakas that are based on normative human behavior and psychology. That is a different level of chazaka. And then, of course, we know that there's a concept of reyesa in a chazaka. Reyesa means there's a reason for us to not fully trust this chazaka because it's clear that something is wrong. So that means it doesn't have the same power that it would otherwise have. We need to take all of those things into consideration if we're talking about how it is that we're going to deal with sfeikas that we have in terms of when a certain situation developed, which we talked about in the beginning of the Masechet, was a rape or an accident. And here we're talking about the sugyas that we've just been dealing with, namely mumim. At what point did these mumim appear? And here it would seem that the same achlokas that we had earlier between Rabbi Gamliel, and this would mean if we put together the issue of Bori Veshema and we take into consideration the Cheskas Haguv and how it impacts upon our assumption that he knew about or didn't know about and so on and so forth. So then we paskin before that we can trust her because she knows, and Rabbi Yoshua on the other hand saying, why are we trusting her? Lo mipia anu chayin, And we learned that those were very complex interrelationships of the nature of Taina in a Beis Din, the difference between Bori Veshema and the different types of Chazaka. Now, it would appear in this Mishnah that we're right back where we started from, and that we're talking, in this case, the same Machlokas as it would impact Mumim. And the only reason that we'd have to go through the whole painful process again is because, of course, the psychological elements here that provide the chazakas that are not chazakas aguf are very different. That ein adam itpayes b'mumin, or a chazaka that people would not be willing to take a woman, which is cutely said as people don't drink from cups unless they look at the cup first, that we spoke about before. And, you know, that would mean that they would have found out whether there's a problem. The only people I know that leave cups open and actually drink from them or have bottles of soda open and drink from them are Americans. Good heavens. But anyway, normal people look before they drink. I cannot tell you how many times I have discovered a small insect that has managed to get into a 1 second uncovered cup. So take that as a lesson. Oh, gosh. I won't tell you some of the stories. All right. Anyway, so comes along with the Mishnah. Ayuba mumim ve'oda bebet avia. So how about if she finds there were mumim while she was in the state of Erisin and she was still living at home? So in other words, there was no nisuin. And now the husband says, well, I don't want to marry her. I refuse to marry her. I don't know about this. And her father is saying, what do you mean you don't want to marry her? She only got this mum after she got engaged to you, you idiot. It's all because of your mazel. She used to be beautiful without any woman. You don't want to marry her? So let's get a ksiva out of you, man. Okay. So what's the din? The father has to bring a raya that, because he's the one, anyway, he's the Baal Din, he's going to get, we're talking about over here, that he was the one that was Mekabel, the Kedusha for her, and he needs to bring a Raya, Shemini Tarsa, Yuba Mumin Halalo, Minis Tachafasa Deo. So the husband's field was flooded. But if she had already been Ichmasel Rishut HaBaal, so it's post-Nisuin, and then we discover these Mumin, and he is saying, Mikacho mekach ta'ut, if he can bring a raya. But he needs to bring a raya that these mumin were there all the time, even when it was back in home. She'ad shelo nitarsa hayuba mumin elu. Then he can say, Mikacho mekach ta'ut. So says Rabbi Meir. And the Chachomim say, when is all of this nogea? When can you claim something that it wasn't known? That's only b'mumim shebeseter. But obviously, if he needed to have known about this mumim because it's right there in the open, of course he cannot make any taina of mikhi mekach ta'ut. Mumim shebegalui, eno yochol liton. And what's more, im yesh merchatz botar, if this city has a bathhouse in which everybody would ultimately be known, their body would be known to everybody else in town. So I understand if you live in a small kfar or whatever, or if you're one of these rich people who actually has a bathroom in their house, which was relatively unheard of because it's almost impossible to eat the water. But, or if you live in a place where you go and you have to clean yourself in the local river and so on. So they're not necessarily, is anybody going to know what you look like without clothes on? But if we're talking about a public bathhouse, a public spa, everybody knows what you look like. And therefore, how could he not know? He would have checked. He would have asked, listen, you see so-and-so. Is there any problem with her body? He would know. So, im yesh merchatz botar, af mumin shebeseter en yochol liton, mipnei shu botka bikrovotel. He's going to ask around, you know, who goes with her to the bathhouse. And we have to assume that he would have found out before he was going to go ahead and even do an erisin. And therefore, you wouldn't be able to tie it. Rabbi Meir obviously doesn't agree with this because he says, listen, I mean, if a woman has something she wants to hide, she'll manage to hide it. I don't know. So she won't go to the bathhouse where somebody's going to squeal on her, or she'll only go with close friends. We're not going to tell him anything. Now, let's take a look at this Mishnah and try to make sense of it. Because the Mishnah really talks about a completely irrelevant difference between the beginning of the Mishnah and the end of the Mishnah. What the heck is the difference where she is? Can you tell me that? Saying, if we found out about this while she was in the father's house, so then we say, oh, you know, he would have to bring a raya that it was there before. But if it's in the husband's house, then the husband has to bring a raya. What? I mean, is there where it is that she's located makes the difference? How possibly could it make a difference? So if you look at the Mishnah, you say the Baal would have to pay a ketuvah if it was discovered in the house of the father, only if the father can bring a proof that these mumin all of a sudden appeared after you, ya jerk, gave her that ring. That was the end of her life. Okay, so then if he can prove that, so then Enochinami, he gets a ketuvah. But if not, then we're going to believe the husband. Where the husband says, well, maybe it was there from before. Now, that's who's Shita. Going back to the beginning of the Masechet, who is the Shita that says, Lo mi pia anu chayin, we don't believe what she says. You got to bring proof. That's Rabbi Yoshua, right? And this is Rabbi Yoshua consistently. So she and the father are saying, no, these women were never there, and you don't know. And he says, I don't know, maybe they were there from before. It's a classic case, same situation we had before. Bori v'shema, we have a cheskas haguv, and we have the cheskas hamomah, and the halacha is that in that case, Rabbi Yoshua says, I don't care if you're going to be, you're going to say that she was born without mumin. The point is, the money gets to stay where it is unless you prove otherwise. And he's the one who says, Lo mi pia anu chayin. Okay, I understand. That's all very nice. It's the same thing as saying, I don't know when she was raped, or I don't know when the accident happened, depending on the machlokas about what the din is of a mukas eitz and so on, but whatever it is. So the Mishnah is very consistent. She has a chazaka that she did not have these mumin at the time that she was born. But the cheskas mumin obviously is the husband. And we're saying if you cannot prove it, you cannot be motzi mumin. So what does that mean? That Rabbi Yoshua is right. That at least in a case of a, or even in a case of a taina of suffix, a cheskas haguf is not going to be usable against the cheskas mumin to be motzi mumin. Okay, that's fine. I mean, I understand this. But I do not understand how you see the Mishnah as not being a contradiction to its own self. Read on, please. Tell me the next case. Of course, it's totally irrelevant that it happens to be that now she's living in the husband's home, right? I mean, what possible difference could that make? So Ema safe. If she's Nichlas El Rishut HaBaal, then the husband has to bring a raya, and if he doesn't, time in my about raya. If he doesn't bring a raya, then the guy's got to pay. Well, who's the one? Who's the man? The Omer says that he has to pay. That's Rebbe Gamliel, who says that we will be motzi mamon because of the fact that we have a bori v'shema and we have the chazaka of the cheskas haguf. All of the issues that we took into consideration at the beginning of the Masechet. I mean, how can you have one Mishnah that flips the shita in the middle and pretends that the very shitas are functions of where? What is going on over here? Do we hold the Rebbe Gamliel or do we hold the Rebbe Yoshua? Omer Rebbe Elazar, this is hopeless. Tavra, the only thing to do is bust the Mishnah into two. Misha Shana Zo, Lo Shana Zo. Rebbe put together two contradictory stories, put them into one Mishnah, to make you aware once again of the various shitas and to work through the different levels of chazaka. It's not meant to hold together. That's how Rashi always understands tavra. Tavra means split it, break it, break it into two. The Tosus learns tavra means what the hell? It means there's no way out of this. It's a curse, basically. Ah, tavra, pa. It's like smashing things, right? Anyway, but the point in Rashi is that it's a reasonable way of constructing a Mishnah, so that if Rebbe wants to bring together two completely different approaches that involve many elements, then what he will do is he will make a Mishnah that points to different considerations that are contradictions and force you to work through all of the possible elements that were part of these contradictions. And as Tosis points out, obviously, there is no possible way that we really thought that the where is irrelevant. Because I mean, you can't put together a Mishnah in a way that pretends that the factor that's important is the where when it's irrelevant completely. So it turns out, we can't do it now because we don't have the information yet. But it turns out that as we work out the differences, we also come to understand why there is meaning in including an additional variable that throws us off the scent and then forces us to realize that there's more involved than we thought. So actually, it's a very brilliant way to construct the Mishnah, which means that Rashi's approach is much more reasonable than saying it's just a curse word, because the point is he is describing a construction of a Mishnah that is Tavra. Okay, so what we'll have to say is Misha Shana Zo, Lo Shana Zo. It's got to be two completely different approaches to life, Chazaka, and the world. Fine. Omar Rava. Rava says, I just want to make one thing very clear. I mean, you're presenting this as an issue about Rabbi Yeshua, and you're saying, well, according to Rabbi Yeshua, the only thing that's important is that we cannot take money from a person because he's got a chazaka, and therefore we'll never utilize a cheskas haguf to prove anything in the event that it's obviously changed, right? I mean, she does have that mum. It's all very nice to say, well, she wasn't born with a mum. I understand she wasn't born with the mum, but that doesn't mean the mum arrived only 2 seconds ago before you look, does it? So, okay, this is the old Schrodinger's cat question, you know? So you peek now, so you believe this is what created the moon? Or this shows that the moon was there earlier? How do you explain that? Okay, so I want to make it very clear, that is not the point, and it isn't true. It's not that Rabbi Yeshua does not take a cheskes haguf as being meaningful. Lo tema Rabbi Yeshua lo azir baser chazaka de guf haklal. Rabbi Yehoshua definitely, in other circumstances, will consider a cheskas haguf to be meaningful in terms of determining the outcome of a din. The only thing that he says is that these two different elements of chazaka, which really are not talking about the same milieu at all, are they? The cheskas hamaman is the question of how we will deal with the halacha in terms of paskening a change in the disposition of money. And the cheskas haguf is a question of how do we take the development of the reality that we're talking about over here, was there or was there not a mum at a particular point, in which case it's irrelevant how we deal with money. One had they're talking past each other, right? So all that Rabbi Yehoshua is saying, says Rava, is that the question of a cheskas haguf, which has changed, is never going to be sufficient to allow a Beis Din to change the way it deals with a cheskas mama. That's all Rabbi Yehoshua holds. But in the event that there is no cheskas mama, of course Rabbi Yehoshua will utilize the chazaka de gufa as a way of getting out of a suffix. And I'll prove it to you from a Mishnah that we had together when we had so much fun learning the goyim. Okay, here's the Mishnah. In Baharat Konem Leseyar Lavan, what's the question is? That in the event that the Baharat comes before the Seyar Lavan, then and only then is it Tame. So remember that the changing of hair into Seyar Lavan, and the growth of hair, which is Lavan, in a Baharat, which is a coloration of the skin, because of a nega, is a called a simen tuma, and we're machlit the nega on that basis, right? On the other hand, if there was seyar lavan here that was growing before there was any kind of nega in the skin, then that seyar lavan is irrelevant and it has nothing to do with the nega. It's only where the nega caused the development of the seyar lavan. Okay, so then it's tar. If there's a suffix, so then the Tanakhama says if there's a suffix, it's tame. Whereas Rabbi Yehoshua says, keha. Now, keha, what does that mean, keha? Assuming that it's spelled with a chof, which is the way that most of the Gersos have it, it means that it turned lighter, meaning fainter. So, what do you mean? Omar Rabba, well, it's as if the nega turned faint, meaning the coloration is no longer as powerful, and that is a simon of Tyra. So Rabbi Yeshua says, treat it as a nega that is keha. Now, others learn, and Rashi brings this as well, that it's keha with a kuf, and keha is afata hakeha chinav, like we have in the Haggadah Shel Pesach, right? So it means when somebody's really upset at something, so that is keha, he sets his teeth on edge, growl. And that is what Rabbi Yeshua is saying. What are you talking about, man? Keha means I'll fight this. Rawr. So in other words, he's arguing. You say that it means it's tummy. I say it means it's tahar. All right. Anyway, so that would mean that even Rabbi Yeshua says that since, look, originally this guy did not have a nega. Now you want to make this a nega that's going to be matame him. I say the cheskas haguf is enough for us to say he was tar from the goyim. He remains tar from the goyim. So you see clearly, says Robert, that Rabbi Yeshua is 100% a chassid of a cheskas haguf. And he uses it against the chachamim. It's only over here where he holds that a cheskas haguf is not motzi mamayim. So make that absolutely clear to you. It's not at all a binary question of whether cheskas haguf is in fact a chazak. Now, this is our first approach to the Mishnah. The Mishnah represents two contradictory shitas, and we don't know why it even mentions the difference between being discovered in the house of the father or being discovered in the house of the Baal, which seems irrelevant. We'll have to work that out as an aside. Rava himself says, look, I basically hold that if the Mishnah has made that the important difference, then the Mishnah means that it's the difference and not the difference between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua. And therefore, I say, and that even though the Mishnah looked like it was going to leave the Rabbi Yeshua, but remember that before we actually paskin like Rabbi Gamliel, the Farish in the Gemara before, I would like to make this Mishnah work out according to Rabbi Gamliel, whether it's the Reisha or the Seifa. See, here's what I would say. I would say that even Rabbi Gamliel is Meida in the first case. Reisha is because we have, this is how Rashi understands it, it's because the Reisha, remember, Reisha means something is rotten in Denmark. Now, something rotten in Denmark means Mizuham, not just sweaty. So therefore, I'm detecting something wrong here. It's a reyasa. What is that reyasa? The reyasa is that, you know, she's still a kid in the father's house. And right there, we discover that the mumin are there. And you're trying to tell me, well, but she was born without mumin. I mean, this is where we discover the mumin. Why should we assume that they hadn't been here earlier? You know? So reyasa kan nimtzu'u kan hayu. We've found them here, and therefore there's no reason for us not to apply this reyasa to the father's taina. And it's very, very likely that they were here before the erusin, because the erusin is irrelevant, and that attacks the taina of the father who's claiming that he gets to collect money based on his cheskas haguf. Masha Enkein, in the seifa, the argument of kan nimtzu'u kan hayu leads to the opposite conclusion. Because if we say that here is where we found them, then we can also say, and here is where they were suddenly appearing once she moved out of the father's house into her husband. And therefore, the chazaka, dafka, would be a reason for having him pay, because it seems to be that it's connected to the circumstances. So even though, obviously, that is the classic meaning of circumstantial evidence. That's totally dependent on the circumstances. But since chazaka is all a series of assumptions that are based on circumstances, the circumstance of where is also a circumstance. And therefore, it weakens the very taina of the father and strengthens the taina against the Baal. And that's the explanation of the Mishnah. Asks Abaye, excuse me. That's not possible. Because if you take a look at the Mishnah, my dear Rava, what does it say over there? It says that the Baal needs to bring a raya. What? What's the raya? The raya has to be that the munin were here before he was mekadesher. And then and only then is mikho mekach ta'ud. Now, why before he was mekadesher? Excuse me? Why can't he just bring a raya that they were here in the father's house? Because you say, once the circumstances are that it was discovered in the father's house, then that is a reyesa in the cheskas ha'av. But the Mishnah disagrees with you. The Mishnah says that the father has to bring a raya that they were there before the erusin. Misha titares lo. But if he brings a raya that they were there at some later point after he gave the erusin, then that's not enough. Why not? Why not? According to you, the only issue is kan nimtzu v'kan hayu. Says Rava, no, that's because you are not taking into consideration other issues, okay? The reason that if he brings a raya that they were there in the father's house, but only known from the point that he had already given her kedushin, there we have another chazaka that destroys it. What's that? That is chazaka in Adam Shosu Bekosel and Kein Botko. People don't drink from a cup without looking at it. And that means that if the mum was here and he knows, then why in the world did he not find out? He knows now. So why didn't he find out before he took her to the chuppah? Because we have a chazaka that people don't do things like that, right? So then he should have. Now, this is a chazaka based on human psychology and norms. It's not the same as a cheskas hagof. It's a different type of chazaka. But nonetheless, it leads us to say that he actually did know about it. And therefore, if he knew about it and nonetheless went to the chuppah, then he was ra'av and itpayes. And the only time that we would say that we don't take that is where we actually can prove that it was there even from before. I don't understand. So even it was there from before. You just messed up the whole Mishnah. Even if he can bring a raya that was there from before, if you're telling me that we have a chazaka that a person doesn't drink from a cup without checking it, so then it's the same chazaka. It was there from before, which means that he could have known about it, and therefore we should assume that if he went ahead and took it to the chuppah anyway, that he was indeed ra'av and itpayes. You're undermining your whole position, Rava. I don't understand you. So then, Achaloti Tares Nami. Ella, why is it no good? Because we have a chazaka against that chazaka. Namely, Amrina chazaka ein adam mitpayes bimumin. That a person who didn't know, he would never have gone ahead and said, okay, I don't care. That's not normal. So then if that's the case, you can use the same chazaka over here too. Even if it was after the erusin, we should rely on the fact, look, don't tell me a person would have checked. If he would have checked and he would have known, he never would have accepted the mumim. I'm sorry. So chazaka in adam mitpayes b'mumim, says Rava. Okay. That's where your subtlety is breaking down. Now, what you don't understand, you see, you're living a binary life by it. To you, it's either or. It's not either or. It is basically a complex interwoven situation with various elements that need to be decided. The current disposition of the money, the nature of the psychology of accepting mumin, the question of whether he knew about it or not. When did the mumin appear in terms of her body? Now, to you, it's either this or that. It's not either. It's a weighing decision, like most judgments are. You need to weigh the factors. Therefore, how about if we get a little bit more sophisticated here, Abaye, and we weigh it? And I'll tell you the point. The reason that if he proves that it was there after Mishinitarsa, there we have two chazakas that are on her side. Namely, First of all, we have the Cheskes HaGuf, and that is that they were not there before the Erisin. HaMeid HaGuf HaCheskeso. Furthermore, we have another Chazak. Ein Adam Shota Bekos, Elin Kin Botko. Now, you are saying, but wait a minute, you just said we have a Chazaka. Ein Adam Mitpayes Bemumin. Okay, that's true. How many factors do we have here? You're bringing me one Chazaka of Ein Adam Mitpayes Bemumin against two Chazakas. Okay, we don't say that because, again, it's a balance of issues. It's not black and white. And since what we need to do is first balance the issues and then determine whether we're going to utilize them against the Cheskes Mammon doesn't figure here at all because first we're trying to establish the facts. Once they're established, then we go about and utilize them to take the money. That's the point. But in the other case, where he does have witnesses that they actually were present before he ever gave the Erisin, so obviously you no longer can say Hamed Gufa Cheskato because we have Edim against that Chazak. So we know for a fact that they were there. So what are you going to taina? My Ika, so what is the reason that we should, nonetheless, we should say that he should have to pay? Because Chazak, Deinonam Shotebeko Selen Kein Botko. He must have seen it, and because he looked at the cup before he drank, didn't he? And he took it to the chuppah. So hayra avinit payesu. So what? Adarabah chazaka inonim payes b'mumi. So basically, over there, you've got one against one, and now we have the hamid mammon al cheskes because we don't have anything to act against the cheskes mammon because in terms of establishing the realities, we're stuck with a one to one. And therefore, the husband doesn't pay. Ha! Whew! Fascinating. Okay, tomorrow, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to see how the factors that we just discussed make it possible for us to go back and understand why the Mishnah would have introduced the placement as being meaningful in the way that we originally understood that indeed it's a machlokas in Tavra, and one is going like Rabbi Yeshua, one is going to leave it at Rabbi Gamaliel. But meanwhile, we've got some very, very fascinating insights. It's because of all of these sugyas, by the way, as I mentioned to you, that Ksuvis has called popularly Shas Katan, because all of the really big sugyas in Shas, they have many, many of their rayas right here in the Sechas Ksuvis, and it's a big, big yeshiva shem sechet, as they say, because of that. Gives you a lot of background to throw around your terminology, and to have a lot of fun.